instructor, and that's not an ideal load. So as long as he's a little bit careful with lead length, with homebrew techniques, can he make a good 50-ohm load resistor at 500 megacycles? Absolutely. But now you know where the minefield is. And so under those conditions, if his microvolt meter, let me drop it. If his microvolt meter does present a 50-ohm load, he's home free. If his microvolt meter is nearly the open circuit type, very high impedance, and he has to provide the load resistor, he can definitely do it with the properly chosen method of mounting surface mount resistors or small carbon composition resistors that are short enough lead length. He can do it. And now he can measure those microvolts. He'll know what the microvolts will become as he goes from short circuit to open circuit, as it describes. It's a 2-to-1 ratio. And anything in between is the formula that's used for time domain reflectometry. And so if you simply Google the word time domain reflectometry, TDR, and you start reading those articles, as you get deeper into it, he'll get the mathematics if he wants it. If he wants to find out, hey, what happens if I terminate it with 120 ohms instead of 50? And the TDR formula will predict exactly what you're going to get. Over to you, John. It's a lot better situation than I thought now that we know it's Weinzel. Weinzel, KC2WGB, K2RIW. You got it, John. Go on to the next one if you want to, or go further with this one. It's your choice.
Well, maybe this would work, Dick. I think the best thing for him to do is to buy a feed-through 50-ohm terminator, like Tektronix makes them. There's a whole bunch of them, BNC connector, and he could fit that on the end of his cable and then plug that into his microvolt meter, and that would guarantee him proper termination without any error.
You did say 50-ohm terminator. Now, if I had a 50-ohm terminating resistor, if I connected that to a T connector, and the T connector's really got, you know, one gazinter and two outputs, and so the cable goes to one end of the T, the terminator goes to the other end of the T, and the third connector now goes to the microvolt meter, and the microvolt meter presents an extremely high impedance, that's one way of putting a 50-ohm terminator in there. And yes, the T connector is a little bit of a shunt impedance. At up to 500 megs, that's going to be a very minor perturbation. You can get away with that. So the terminator usually is only a one-terminal connector thing. If it was a two-terminal connector, a gazinter and a gazouter, almost always it's going to be a 50-ohm impedance attenuator, 3, 6, 10 decibels of attenuation or whatever, which is another thing to worry about with calibration. By the way, if he did choose a 6 decibel attenuator, 6.02 dB to be exact, a 6 dB attenuator, not only would it present a 50-ohm load, and there's a catch on that one, it would present a nearly 50-ohm load, but the 6 dB attenuator is exactly a 2-to-1 ratio. If on the output of the attenuator you measure 10 microvolts, you know that what went into it was 20 microvolts. The catch is that a 6 decibel attenuator only presents 6 dB of attenuation if it also sees 50 ohms on its output lead. So, life's complicated. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, well, we'll leave him a few options anyway. I know that has approximately 18 dBm output, I believe, if it's similar to mine. So it's got a lot of potential. They do make a pass-through terminating device that'll place 50 ohms on the BNC connector and then pass the signal through to the meter on the other end. It's a Gozinta and Gozata, just like you said. All right, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to the next one.
This one is called the CalPad, KC2QIQ.
Well, oh, it's called a calibration pad. Is that what you called it, Glenn? Give us a couple of words on that one, Glenn.
Yeah, normally there's test sets where you have cal pads, in other words, you can have, 6 dB attenuators, 3 dB attenuators, 10 dB, all the way up to, I think they make them maybe even as high as 15, 60, I'm sure I've seen. And usually you'll have opens in there, shorts in there, and terminations. You know, it usually comes as a test kit, part of a spectrum network analyzer
Yeah, Mori Microwave. You go to the website of Mori. I'm not quite sure how it's spelled, but phonetically it's called Mori Microwave. And they make the world's best, in my opinion, terminating sets, short opens and terminations for calibrating vector network analyzer. When you buy the termination calibration kit from Hewlett Packard for their vector network analyzer, and possibly, but I'm not sure, if you buy the calibration kit for a vector network analyzer manufactured by Rode and Schwartz, in both cases, you're probably getting the Mori calibration kit, just rebranded, relabeled it to the brand name. Mori is a major company in California building those things, and they build them to ridiculous accuracy. I suspect that their 50-ohm termination on the SMA connector, for instance, for a vector network analyzer, probably up to 18 gigahertz, has a standing wave ratio of, 1.001, so to speak. Extremely good, probably 50, 60 decibels of reflection coefficient on those terminations for the termination, and they make a perfect short and open. By the way, when it comes to the CAL kit for a vector network analyzer, one of the things that doesn't make sense is that when you build a SMA connector, let me drop. When you build an SMA connector with a 50-ohm termination built into it, how much physical length is inside the 50-ohm termination does not matter, because all the signal flowing down the SMA 50-ohm connector goes into the termination, all of it dies, and whether the length inside is a millimeter or a mile, you wouldn't know the difference. But there's a catch. In the case of the calibration short circuit and open circuit, you've got a certain length of connector. The signal's going to flow down that connector, and it's then going to hit internally a perfect short circuit or a perfect open circuit that is some number of millimeters downrange. In the calibration procedure of your vector network analyzer, you have to first know that the manufacturer of your precision short and open told you it is X number of millimeters downrange. You have to tell your vector network analyzer how many millimeters downrange is that real short and that real open inside of that thing. It's got physical length. You have to tell the machine what the length is. Otherwise, your calibration procedure has got an error factor you didn't know about. You can't make a short circuit with a real connector, or an open circuit with a real connector, have zero length, because the connector itself has got length, if you know what I mean. Some people forget about that little detail. It's not gonna make it explode and catch on fire, but some of your measurements are not gonna be quite as much precision as you'd like. KC2WGB, KQRIW, very John.
KC2WGB. That's why the calibration kit's at $3,000. And you put the connector on and you tell it whether it's an open or a short, and it makes its calculations. Let me let it drop. I'm glad Glenn is here with us, Dick, because I got a transformer question from this gentleman. Let me let it drop.
I'm always glad when Glenn is here. Go ahead, John.
Okay. Got a young man in Brooklyn who has a transformer that he's using for a project. And he knows it's a 60-cycle transformer, and he knows it's 10 to 1, so he's got... He gets his 10 volts in, or his 110 volts in, he gets his 10 volts out. Basically, he's looking for a 10 or 11 volt circuit. His problem is he doesn't know how much wattage or how much current he can draw from this transformer. There's no label on it other than the manufacturer. And there's the label that was on it, I guess, came off or whatever. All it has is GE. So he'd like to know, how can he tell how much current he can draw from this transformer without overloading it? Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, John. And before we go there, I heard somebody sign in called KB2IQN. And maybe Chris wants to say something. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, just a real brief comment about the... the length of the bullet that you give to the network analyzer. The network analyzers that I've seen for Agilent require that you put that in as a time delay, as in like an order of 6 to 9 nanoseconds. rather than an actual physical length. Go ahead.
Good point. Because the way you build an internal short circuit or an open circuit probably is made out of a 50-ohm connector and a 50-ohm minor transmission line of some kind, which has some kind of velocity factor. That velocity factor means that the equivalent electrical length is longer than the physical length. Your calipers might measure 5 millimeters, but the real electrical length might act like 6 millimeters because it happens to have, let me pick a number, 85% velocity factor cable inside, so to speak. So to calibrate it in nanoseconds makes some more sense. All right, when it comes to the transformer, I'm going to make a guess on this one, then I'm going to turn it over to Glenn, because the transformers are his raison d'etre. In other words, magnetic circuits is the reason that Mother Nature put him on this planet, in my opinion. I'm going to make a guess that when it comes to a power transformer, assuming this is a power transformer with a 10-to-1 ratio, and it's not intended for audio, because a little bit of some funny factors come in with audio circuits. So assuming that it's a 60-cycle or a 400-cycle, I got to be careful about that one. If it's a 60-cycle power transformer, then the amount of watts is directly proportional to the number of pounds of iron. In other words, you look at the physical size, you weigh it, these are my guesses, you look at the physical size and you weigh, you know how much iron is there, and so a transformer that's good for 10 watts of feed-through is going to have a certain number of ounces of weight to it, a certain amount of iron is required to have enough aperture to wind the right number of turns in the primary or the right gauge wire and so on. So weight, I think, is a very strong clue that will get you into the ballpark. Let's see what Glenn says about that one. KC2QIQ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, it's a very good point, Dick. When you have a transformer that's unlabeled, that's always a problem. But with 60-cycle magnetics, it really probably isn't as much of a problem as you think. And what I would do in this particular case is find the manufacturer that there was sometimes, if you go online, you can find out if there are similar manufacturers that make like, if it's like an E-Core type of design, laminate, where you can find something online of a manufacturer that makes something similar to it and look up for similar ratings and look, you know, measure the width and the length and diameter of the size of the transformer and find with a similar output voltage and then check ones that are online. And you can check with, look at DigiKey, look at some, and they usually will give you dimensions of the transformers, and that will probably give them a pretty good indicator of the power level of a 60-cycle transformer, John. But that's what I would do. I would compare it to other known manufacturers of similar size, and that'll probably get them in the ballpark. Back to you, Dick, K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I like the sound of that. And if you do the measurements of length, width, height, and or weight, and you find that a similar transformer by some other brand was, let me pick a number, good for 10 watts of power feed-through. And in his case, he's getting 10 volts of output. If you do it with approximately 10 watts, and 10 volts at 10 watts is going to be 1 ampere. 1 ampere, 10 volts is 10 watts. 60-cycle RMS, 10 volts. That puts you into the ballpark. You know darn well by the size of the transformer, it's nowhere near 100 watts. You know by the size of the transformer, it's nowhere near 1 watt. By the size, you might measure and calculate that similar devices of other brand names, if you can't find it in the GE catalog, so to speak, it's GE brand name. And if he finds out that he thinks it's 10 watts, and it's really 15 watts or it's really 7 watts, That's not a showstopper. If you get it wrong by 30%, high or low, if you're underrating it, no sweat. If you're overrating it by 30%, and while you're using it, you put your hand on it and you make sure it's not getting super hot to the touch, you're in good shape. So with 30% possible error, size is going to tell him, that tells him the ballpark. And if he needs a 5-watt transformer and he calculates 10 watts, he's in like Flynn. If he calculates 10 watts and he needs a 30-watt transformer, he's probably in trouble. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, that gives us some great information. Yeah, that, I would agree with that. If you can go by size and weight and look at something comparable online, he'll be close. And again, monitoring the temperature when he's using it. He's using it for a power supply for a preamp, so it can't be that bad. It can't be that big. But, yeah, great. Let me do a drop, and I'll go on to the next quick one. Okay, this one's an oscilloscope question. This gentleman has a fairly decent oscilloscope, but he notices that the waveform, if he has a 60-cycle waveform displayed, stability is good, everything's fine. He notices at the top of the curve, the width of the line, the trace, is exaggerated. And it seems like he has a birdie riding on the top of the trace, but it covers the whole top of the trace. So it looks like he's got a broadband birdie riding up there. And that is with just pure 60 cycle going into it. Do you have any tips for him? What he should look for?
Yeah, when I pass it back to you, John, my first question is going to be, did he give you a photograph of what he sees off the screen? Where the top of the trace looks wider than the rising and descending portions of the trace, there's a slim chance that there's a peculiar kind of out-of-focus characteristic of the cathode ray tube, if it is a cathode ray type oscilloscope. If it's a modern-day solid-state screen, you know, thin screen type oscilloscope, life gets a little bit more complicated. You're saying that the top looks like it's got a birdie riding on it. It's got extra width to it. Does the bottom of the 60-cycle waveform also have it? Because in order to have a birdie on only the upper part, but not the lower part, for Mother Nature to do that out in the real world is rare and unusual. If it's something that's taking place inside of his oscilloscope, where it breaks into a Funkhausen oscillation on the only upper half of a sine wave, and only when the sine wave is made a certain size on the screen, that's another clue. As he changes the vertical gain control, the click-click round knob on the oscilloscope, and he goes to a bigger and smaller display, does the width of the signal change in a non-characteristic way? So give me a couple more hints. Did you have a photograph, and did you see it? Or are you only going by the word description here, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
You should have sent me a photograph, and we could have helped him a lot more. Apparently, as he increases or decreases the amplitude, the birdie stays about the same width and the same height. That doesn't change from his description, and it's only on the top part of the waveform. Which I don't understand that. He sent a hand drawing, and that's what that's showing. So that's a strange one, Dick.
It sure is. And it does, at first, sound like there's a failure within the oscilloscope, an extremely unusual failure. Whatever his source of signal is, if it's a 60-cycle signal, do you know where the 60 cycles is coming from? If I take the scope probe and just lay it on the table or put my finger on the center conductor of the scope probe and I pick up the local 60-cycle E-field that's in my laboratory, I'll get some really wild-looking waveforms. Yeah, because the whole darn United States is fed with 60 cycles, there is a 60-cycle E-field and H-field everywhere, coming out of every one of your transformers, coming out of the household wiring, coming out of the pole pick transformer out in front of the house. There's 60-cycle minor waveforms everywhere. If you've got a sensitive enough scope, you'll pick them up. But you're picking up a weird mixture, and you get very weird waveforms. If you take your Con Ed or LIPA power through a real transformer or some other kind of voltage divider network, and that goes into a well-shielded, well-grounded, calibrated oscilloscope probe, and then into the oscilloscope, you should get the most beautiful-looking sine wave you've ever seen. The fact that he's getting these birdies only on the upper half, and assuming it's coming from a clean source, not just a e-field pickup in the laboratory, you know what I mean? It's coming from a clean source. And it does suggest that there's a peculiar characteristic in the oscilloscope, particularly where you said, I'm dropping. As he changes the gain and changes the size of the signal displayed, that the birdie riding on top doesn't change. I mean, if I change the gain of the scope by 2 to 1, the peak-to-peak of the sine wave should change by 2 to 1. And if the signal coming in the front panel really has that birdie on the upper half, then the birdie is going to change by 2 to 1 in peak-to-valley. Not just the birdie of peak-to-valley on the top or half of the sine wave. So where he's got this birdie that doesn't change, there is a failure within the scope. Not a serious one, but something worth investigating. If it's got tubes, maybe it's time to do some tube checking and tube substitution. In the case of, say, for instance, the EastKit 012 oscilloscope, it had all kinds of peculiar characteristics because the 12BH7, I think it is, was the push-pull output tube that drove the vertical plates. Those tubes always became gassy. As they became gassy, they drew extra current. As they drew extra current, they put extra current in the biasing resistors on the cathode to ground. As those resistors got overcooked, they changed in value. In some cases, there were a 270-ohm resistor that went to 1,000 ohms, or in some cases, there were 270-ohm resistor that went down to 18 ohms. You know, drastic change in the resistor being cooked. And they had all kinds of peculiar characteristics, in which case, a very simple, let me drop. A very simple test procedure by which you take your volt-ohm-milliammeter or your digital voltmeter in the ohm-meter scale with the oscilloscope turned off and unplugged, and you just simply measure every one of the cathode bias resistors, every one of the plate voltage-dropping resistors, every one of the coupling capacitors for leakage. You do some very simple ohm-meter tests. And in the case of a HeathKit 012 oscilloscope, for instance, you'll find all kinds of things that have changed 10 years downrange from the day it was manufactured and or assembled because of tube gassy failures and all other kinds of things. So if it's a solid-state oscilloscope, then this phenomenon is very difficult to explain. If it's an old-fashioned tube-type oscilloscope, there's a zillion ways that a tube failure and other components around the tubes failing could give him that response. It's rare, but I've heard of such things before, John. KC2WGB, drag your feet a little bit because we've got some oscilloscope experts in the tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. Maybe somebody's going to chime in and say, aha, I've seen that, and here's what it was. KC2WGB with some delay. K2RIW on the TechNav.
KC2QIQ with 60 cycle power company waveform comments later, Dick. KC2QIQ.
Now, why don't you give it to us right now, Glenn? This is the appropriate time.
So I was just saying, a lot of times when you hold up and you look at a sample of a power line coming in from LiPo or your power company, the waveform usually looks kind of ugly. It doesn't look like the sine wave that you'd really expect. And one of the reasons for that, Dick, is because one of the ways that the power company actually does the regulation of the voltage on power lines, you figure out, how do they regulate, you know, voltage if the primary winding is all parallel windings? They're running over miles and miles in length between the generating source and out to the transformer. One of the ways they do that regulation, Dick, is they run the transformers into saturation. The primary winding is actually, because it's being driven by a generator and inductive wire lengths, they literally run the transformers into saturation. So you do get this kind of like flat topping on all the transformers, and they reset themselves on every cycle as they swim through zero. So yeah, some of those waveforms from the power company can be pretty ugly. KC2QIQ.
Oh, that's a brand new one on me, Glenn. Glenn, you and I have used a device called a constant voltage transformer. A constant voltage transformer has a kind of primary winding resonance going on. In other words, it's a very specific transformer which has got the equivalent of a swinging choke on the primary. Usually there's a great big oil-filled capacitor attached to it. And the net result is that the so-called constant voltage transformer has a controlled amount of iron saturation such that if you're if your primary power going in is anywhere from 102 volts to 140 volts, the whole circuit acts like 118 plus or minus 2 volts, so to speak. It's got a beautiful voltage waveform. It does give you a slightly modified waveform coming out, but the RMS is beautifully controlled. So are you telling me that my pole pig has some of that characteristic? If so, that's a brand new one on me. And the thing that worries me a little bit is that every one of those so-called constant voltage transformers I've ever used, they make a lot of 60-cycle hum, a lot of magnetostriction acoustics coming out of there, a lot of heat coming out of the darn thing. And so because Loco is very efficiency-minded and power-factor-minded, that so-called constant voltage transformer does produce a pretty yucky power factor on the primary. I'm amazed if LIPA or Con Ed could tolerate that. So are you sure that a significant number of the pole pigs fall into that category, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, they actually do. They're pretty ugly. As I said, it's as amazing as we think of our power company distribution, it's pretty crude. they run them right into saturation. And it's amazing, and that's how they actually maintain most of the voltage regulation. Because if you think of the distribution problem, the miles and miles of wire that they have to run, and that's one of the reasons they like to maximize the voltage, is because when they run these things into saturation, they want to make sure that and there's just so much reactive energy. There was another analysis that was done many, many years ago where somebody said, we should teach the power companies a lesson. They just, everybody have a power-off moment where everybody decides to shut off their power, and we'll teach the power companies a lesson. And the distribution engineers went crazy because when they heard that, they thought, oh my goodness, well, everything went unloaded at once. It could actually burn up the whole power system. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'm convinced that's a bit of an exaggeration. If everybody tried to turn off everything in their house, you'd be amazed how difficult it is to do. To pull the main circuit breaker, yes, you could probably do that for a house. But the real heavy drain on Con Ed and LIPA are your factories, air conditioning, lighting in parking lots, all kinds of things that are very difficult to turn off. So on paper, it sounds like you could create a lot of mischief doing that. To really pull it off would be tough, in my opinion. But now, while we're on power, I just read in the latest issue, the Sunday issue of Newsday, that Cuomo is very unhappy with Con Ed's performance during Hurricane Sandy, the Superstorm Sandy, that 1.2 million residents, a million customers of Nassau and Suffolk County, 1.2 million were without power at some portion of Sandy. Therefore, it's easy for him sitting up there in Albany to say, okay, that's a terrible company, they misrun. And so he's in the talking phase of having New Jersey Power and Light, or somebody in New Jersey is going to take them over and all this is going to go away. Come on. You're going to take this 100-year-old system with all of its glitches of its individual installation way back in the dark ages, and you're going to bring it up to speed. Where's the money going to come from to do that? We've already got the highest possible rates in all of the continental United States. To replace that equipment would take you $1 zillion. Nobody's going to do it. Without replacing the equipment, you're going to get trees falling on them. You're going to get failures and whatever that are difficult to explain. To say that the company is mismanaged, and that's why so many people in this once-per-100-year storm were without power, that's very naive. I'm having great trouble believing that everything is going to suddenly turn hunky-dory just because we, for the third time, intend repeater. Time out. Just because we, for the third time in 10 years, go over to some other organization running the situation, all of a sudden everything's going to turn beautiful. You believe that, and I'm going to sell you another piece of that bridge that I own in Brooklyn. What's your opinion on all this one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I have to agree with you to a certain extent that a lot of the problems with bringing things back on after a hurricane, especially something that large, is always going to be a problem. And politicians are always going to react if they have an answer. But I think there are other underlying causes. Like you said, one of the things, differences, like if you look at Pennsylvania Power and Electric and a lot of other states, they've got rules and regulations to how close you can grow a tree to a power line, just specifically for those reasons. That, you know, I mean, if you wanted to certainly make sure the power stayed on and didn't damage the power lines as much, one of the biggest problems here on Long Island is that we have trees growing right underneath power lines. And, you know, they send out a storm dish and they go out there and they start cutting the trees around the power line. You know, but hey, the tree goes over, it's going to take the power lines down. You remove the trees, but do we, you know, what kind of lifestyle do we want to live with? Do we want to live with the trees or live with the power outages? You know, so it's, you know, that's one of the problems. But let me let it drop. There's another opinion here.
I'm going to stop you for a second on this one. And that is, in the case of Hurricane Sandy, two of my tulip and oak trees, I think one was tulip and one was oak, but anyhow, they were roughly 80-foot high trees, 30 feet back on my property, the straightest looking things you've ever seen, very healthy trees. These two healthy trees went directly across the county road in front of my house and brought down the power line. 30 feet back on my property, a healthy looking tree. If they were going to trim the trees to stop that from happening, they went 30 feet back on a private piece of property, my property, and started trimming that tree. In theory, I'd be out there with my shotgun. So they could not have prevented a situation like that. Yeah, they could have made it better, the trees that are super close wrapped around the wires.
Repeater, time out.
But for LIPA or Con Ed to have protected themselves against that particular situation, and by the way, 50 tons of wood fell on my property, and I'm still in the process of removing it. I've removed about 25 tons so far. I got a lot to go. And yes, I could get it professionally done, but I like the exercise I'm getting, and I'm learning a lot about using a chainsaw. So just trimming the trees is not going to protect you very much from a Hurricane Sandy situation. It's part of what's going on here. I'm having great trouble believing that everything's going to turn hunky-dory just because a third entity is now going to be controlling that particular system. KC2QIQ, KQLIW, go ahead, Glenn.
But Dick, I agree with you with the trees. I mean, heck, you'd have to cut down so many trees before you could actually reach that benefit. I mean, there are states that when they put the poles in, there are moratoriums that were in place well before the trees ever get planted. So, I mean, you know, in those kinds of situations, but here on Long Island, you literally have to strip, like, the amount of trees off here, like you said, nobody wants to do that, you know, so that's kind of, like, out of the question really at this point. The other thing is, you know, looking at the power company's performance over, let's say, the last 50 years in response to hurricanes, through different levels of management in different years, there's been better responses. This past performance on a lot of scales, and they do use a lot of measures to measure it, and they came in with failing grades on a lot of it, and so there were a lot of problems. And I can see that there's frustration there, but here again, is the solution to, you know, get rid of who's in there and put somebody new in, or just, you know, make sure that people are more accountable? I think accountability always speaks a lot louder than just swapping people out every so often. But there again, just an opinion, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
And that so-called accountability, a great word, rolls off the tongue easily. How do you do an objective evaluation of accountability of something as massive as a power system feeding 2.5 million people on this little island called the Island of Long? I mean, no matter how you come up with a monthly report card, I guarantee it's going to be a hell of a lot more subjective. The situation is half as bad as you're going to decide that this school is high performance for my students, and this school is not high performance. I'm going to close down that school and fire all those teachers. And you try doing that. Well, how are you going to come up with that number? Well, we'll give them a standard test and find out how well they do in the test. And you find out that the various people in the school say, gee, we're about to be closed down if they don't come up to a high enough score. So we're going to spend all of our effort making sure we teach the students in such a way that they perform well on that particular test. The hell with everything else in the curriculum, because our job is on the line. and if need be, in the back room, we'll start correcting some of those grades when they did take the test. We'll start erasing some of the marks and putting in new marks, because my job is on the line. I mean, so the method by which you do accountability evaluation, boy, you got to go slow on that one. There's only 50 ways you can do it wrong. So I'm not convinced. I know we've gone way far left of center here, John.
Can I add something to that?
Go for it, John. Go for it, Glenn.
I'm pretty sure I've mentioned this before. Since Hurricane Sandy, and you can verify this in quite a few different areas, that LIPA had violated a lot of regulations that they shouldn't have. There were just things that they left themselves short on. Certain employees that were supposed to be called in, that were supposed to be on call, materials that they were supposed to have on backup. When a president calls ahead of time in an emergency zone, there's certain procedures that they're supposed to follow, some of which is cutting off the electricity, some of it is to have things on order, and they didn't follow a lot of those rules that are already there. So, I mean, if you don't follow the rules that are there, that's a pretty good indicator right from the get-go, especially when other places had and did much better. I think you can use that as a starter. Here again, just that, I think that's a little bit more than an opinion, though. Case of 2QIQ.
Okay, there's enough blame to go around in this one, Glenn. Certain things are supposed to be in the stockroom to make sure you've got the raw materials on hand to do all the repairs when a Hurricane Sandy comes along. But if one of your big failure items, I don't know if it was, if one of your big failure items is power pole transformers, and if those transformers, you don't buy them new, you always buy them rebuilt, and to get a rebuilt one, you have to give them the discarded core of the old one, and they rewire it for you and send it back to you. So having enough of them on hand is a bit of a problem. Second of all, if the Public Service Commission has set certain standards as to what's supposed to be in the stockroom, the Public Service Commission has the responsibility for doing a periodic inspection to make sure it's really there. Did that inspection take place? If the inspection didn't take place, and you know it's never taken place, and it's not going to take place, and you can make the situation have cost-wise a little bit more efficiency by not having all of this stock sticking in the storeroom and tying up your tax money, tying up your inventory, tying up your warehousing, and when you've got the highest rates in the whole United States there, and you can make it a little bit better by not stocking so deeply because no one ever checks, you can see there's enough blame to go around. Did the Public Service Commission demanding those amount of stock in the stockroom ever inspect it? If not, why not? And everybody knows they're never going to inspect it. And if you were running the company, would you still stock that deeply and cost that much extra money and raise the rates accordingly for doing that? You see where I'm going with this one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, Dick, keep in mind, one of the reasons our rates are as high as they are is because some of those factors are already built in there. So in other words, the pricing that they put on electricity is based on certain factors. In other words, it's not a free market where they compare rates to just about everything. They actually do run, they're regulated to how they can charge. And one of the reasons why it's high in this area is because of those things are calculated in. So they have to pay attention to that. That's why, otherwise we should be paying less money for our electric rates as consumers. So there's a lot to this. And there's a lot of accountability, and I think you're going to see this go on for quite some time. It's going to be a problem. And I think even they realize the politicians are getting so involved in this one is because they figure if they don't do something, so many things were overlooked, and the rates are so high, that people are going to scream, and that's where things are. KC2QIQ.
Glenn, it's my belief that one of the major reasons our rates are so high in Long Island is Shoreham Nuclear Station. The Shoreham Nuclear Station cost $8 billion and for all practical purposes never generated a kilowatt hour. $8 billion was spent, and now you've got this hope of a power station out there where people are coming and stealing the copper wire and whatever around there, and we're still paying for that, and we'll be paying for it for some time. That may be the biggest factor. We're still paying that $8 billion past bill that started way back in 1970. I may be wrong on that one. Over to you, Glenn, for a comment, K2LAW.
Yeah, I don't believe we're actually paying for that anymore, Dick. I know that that was calculated in. There was supposed to be a drop in the rates, and part of that was because there was it was another federal bailout. You know, what happened was the state said that what they were going to do is they were going to buy the power company from MoCo at the time for $1, and that was that guy William Catacasinos, and I forget who the governor was at the time, but it was a whole big, you know, hoopla back then, and you know, then the state came in, they bought it out, and then there was an increase in taxes, but then again, there was also an increase in rates, so that was supposed to be amortized, and I think it was supposed to be 15 years, and it's been a lot more than 15 years, Dick, but the rates never came down. So in fact, they've actually gone up, and there's been taxes added to that on top of that, and well, many of the excuses that have been used to maintain the high rates is that they said that the distribution system is very, very expensive to maintain. But as we find out during a major storm, they haven't been maintaining it. Oops. KC2QFQ.
My understanding, Glenn, is that this thoroughly independent organization called Public Service Commission studies the situation and allows them to charge certain rates. Are you saying the Public Service Commission is telling them to charge us the wrong rate? Is that why our rates are too high? If our rates are too high and it's under the permission of the Public Service Commission, should we blame local for that? Over to you, Glenn, K2LAW.
Yeah, so of course, because think about it for a minute. There's reasons why the rates are set at a certain area. They look at an area, they figure out there's a certain population density, there's a certain amount of area. You are expected to follow certain codes. You have to build transformers with certain isolation, have to operate at certain voltages. You have to have poles a certain height and size. You have to use certain wire gauges. You have to supply a certain amount of transformers for X amount of load. You have to have backup. I mean, there are regulations on top of regulations. This whole thing, it's completely regulated. That's the irony of this whole situation. And the bottom line is if you follow all the regulations, and if something comes up, then you can say, hey, I followed all the regulations, you know, that's the best I can do. But when you don't follow the regulations, then there's a problem. So they didn't follow the regulations, Dick, and that's really what they're coming up with.
The Public Service Commission is an independent, non-LOCO, non-LIPA organization looking over the shoulder of LOCO. In theory, if they're doing their job, they know exactly what's going on. If they had some magic formula by which they know that LOCO can, that LIPA can make this change and that change, and all of a sudden the operation would run so much more smoothly, so much more economically, that the rates would drop. If the Public Service Commission has that knowledge and is not using it, what the heck's going on here? And if they're charged with finding that knowledge and they don't know it and haven't found it, are they doing their job? You got this independent organization looking over the whole situation, setting the rates. Where's their responsibility in this situation, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LAW?
My understanding, Dick, is that it's not a closed-loop system. The PSE&G, the Public Service, Electric and Gas, and all that, that whole administration that sits down and regulates this whole situation, is not a governing body. They're a regulation body. So, in other words, it's like in Europe, they have an IEC, not an FCC. FCC is a governing body. Not only are they responsible for the regulations, but they're also responsible for enforcement, and there is no enforcement on this end. So in other words, the only other thing is that with something like a power company, which is a public utility, is that they have to follow the certain rules. But when they don't, you know, as you said, so there's no closed loop. I'm sure that there is some, I think basically how it's handled is lawsuits. you know, from what I understand, but I'm not sure of all the details to it. I'm not that deeply involved in it, but I don't believe that the Public Service Commission is a governing body. I think that's what the problem is. That it's really the, up to the company owners and the I guess who the overall regulators are. But I'm not sure where all those rules and regulations come in to who enforces it.
Okay, let me go one step further with that. You're implying that the Public Service Commission, the overseer, looking over the shoulder of Loco, in theory, they're charged with the responsibility of knowing what's happening and knowing whether or not the rules are being followed. They are a regulator, but they don't have the power of enforcement, is what you just told me. If they had some magic piece of knowledge of where LIPA is doing it incorrectly, and they can't enforce it, they're regulating, but they can't enforce it. All they'd have to do is take that knowledge, display it in Newsday, and say, this is what we found, this is what should take place, this is the problem. If they put that magic piece of knowledge in Newsday, and you and I read it, we'd be screaming and hollering and saying, you better, LIPA, you better change in this way. Does the SEC, even though they don't have enforcement capability, but they do have regulatory committee capability, they have the power of the press as the best enforcement in the world. If they've got this knowledge and they're not using it and they're holding that light under the bushel basket, maybe it's time we replace the SEC people. Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
I like, you know, here again, Dick, I'm not sure exactly how the whole thing works. I at this point in time, I do know that there is, you know, a lot of finger pointing going on, you know, from the governor down. And, you know, as I said, because there's, you know, when people aren't following the regulations, the rules, you know, people have already been fired and let go. And they, I mean, there's so many things that have happened so far since this whole thing. But, you know, how much of it's actually been in the media? Is the public really that interested? I don't know. I know that everybody knows that there was a severe problem there. Everyone knows the electric rates are too high. But, you know, it's just that, you know, every time there's an issue, it always goes back to the power company. And I guess people just feel, after a while, like nothing is getting done. You know, it's like our electric rates are high and the service stinks. Welcome to Long Island, KC2QIQ.
Be careful now, Glenn. When you say the service stinks, what's your criteria? You talk to any of the people I've ever worked with that go to Egypt, India, Africa, many parts of the world, South America, Colombia. You talk to the people who go there, and you find out X number of hours every single day the power goes out. And the people who can afford it have got standby generators in order to keep their house running during those periods of time every single day. There are massive portions of the world, the majority of the world, by your and my standards, does not have clean water, does not have clean power. Your and my standard is that I'm willing to tolerate a power interruption of 30 seconds per year. I'm putting numbers on it, but you know what I mean. We've got extremely high standards by world standard characteristics. The small amount of power outage that I've had, you know, 4 days at a time or whatever, during an Irene, Gloria, or Sandy, that doesn't bother me. You and I can roll with those punches. It's a strong inconvenience. Yes, if I had a person with a serious medical problem where a particular machine had to be maintained, yes, I've got to do some extra things. Let me drop. But still, I think you and I have got very high standards, worldwide speaking. And when it comes to reliability of power in the United States, I think that a power company that's higher than ours in rate in Hawaii quite possibly has considerably less reliability than we have. But again, it's where is your standard? I mean, you and I would like to have the cell site, the wired telephone, the cable system for television, the internet connection, and the power. We'd like them to go out 30 seconds per year maximum. That's what we would like. But now, where's the real world? I mean, it's easy to complain. What would you do instead? If you were the head of NOCO, LIPA, right now, I know there's no great answer, but I could ask you and everybody else, what would you do instead under these exact conditions? And are your standards a little too high when we... It's easy to complain. I could easily say, I wish I was a rich person, I wish everybody loved me, and I wish that the world was beautiful. Well, let's get realistic. I'll hold you for a 500. I don't know if I've asked your question or not, Glenn. T2QIQ, T2REW.
Yeah, I don't want to go on too long with this sort of pipe and that too much, but I just think, you know, I understand where you're coming from, Dick, but keep in mind, too, there are some measures here that we can use. We can look at, yes, other places in the world have much worse electric power service than we have, but they pay a whole heck of a lot less for their electric than we do. There are other areas inside the United States where the service is worse than here. This is true. But there again, many power companies, if you look at their reliability curves over time, they're improving. Long Island, there's been a direct correlation to electric power service and reliability that's been going down, and our rates are going up. So the curves don't match. So there are some problems there. What all the fixes are, I'm not really sure what they are. I mean, I know that certainly if they follow the regulations might be a good starting point, but... Here again, Dick, these are just more words from the peanut gallery on this end. Back to you, Dick. K2RW, K2QIQ.
Yeah, from my point of view, this is an appropriate subject because we amateurs pride ourselves in the ability to have the equivalent of standby power. We have enough batteries in our automobiles and our handy talkies and whatever so that when all hell breaks loose and the Hurricane Sandy comes along, we're able to keep our radios working in general. So we're very good at that. Therefore, power reliability is, in my opinion, although it's pretty far off to one side, ham radio-wise, is still an appropriate subject. And, John, I know that the poor guy who asked the original question that got us off on this tirade was asking about the size of a transformer. And I think you've got at least one more question we should be handling tonight, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Well, we also have Paul waiting in the wings, too. I just wanted to mention this, Dick. He was measuring this waveform on this oscilloscope with a little 6-volt filament transformer. But one thing I'm going to ask him to do is send me photographs. And also, he's only showing me one waveform, and it's a cycle and a half with the positive waveform in the center, and that's where the birdie is. Now, I wonder what happens if you would collapse it to a straight line. Is the birdie there? Because I've had that happen with oscilloscopes and quite a few times. And it's a different problem, total different problem. So I will write him back on that. I hope he's listening tonight, and maybe he'll understand what I need.
A 60-cycle filament transformer should give you pretty clean power. So... sideways you get out of that normally is clean as all hell, and therefore the oscilloscope should be able to display that. Over to you, John, for another one, or do you think it's time we should go over to Paul? Your choice. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Yes, Dick, I'll put the rest on the shelf for next week, and let's go over to Paul and see what he's got for us. Something interesting, as usual. Great discussion. Good information. And thank you, Glenn. Okay, back to you, Dick.
Okay, Jane, after Paul.
Roger. Paul, I wonder if you had a chance to see that 30-meter telescope, TMT, that's what it's called. Yeah. That's going to be built in Hawaii. The Land Management Hawaii has given the approval. And can you imagine a 30-meter telescope that's 98 feet in diameter? When it comes to a single piece of glass, the biggest piece of glass we have ever built is the 200-inch Mount Palomar. It's a little bit over 16 feet in diameter. When you go from 16 feet in diameter to 98 feet in diameter, is that a telescope? Wow. Is that going to see things? Wow. Still ain't seen nothing yet. These optical telescopes with their adaptive optics, which you can take out an awful lot of the shimmer of the atmosphere are such that we used to think Hubble in space was the be-all, end-all. But there's great big apertures we can put on the ground. We can correct an awful lot of what goes through the atmosphere. We're making some pretty big improvements. Yeah, you don't get the infrared and the ultraviolet through the atmosphere, but still, we do some darn good observing. So what else has NASA been doing? Interesting stuff. So WS2N, give us a brief transmission to make sure it's coming through clean tonight, Paul. KQIAW, you got a problem.
Okay, this is WS2N, space portion of the net, of the TechNet. The telescope that, once they built Tech, that was the first one that I sort of was all segmented like that, and that was a success. Everything else followed. How copy?
A beautiful copy, Paul. Please proceed.
Yeah, it was soon after that they decided let's make the next generation telescope, which now they call the James Webb Space Telescope, the biggest one to put it into space, all segmented. So that's a good way to go. Lightweight, made of beryllium frames, and you know, you can launch something like that into out of space with not much of a problem. It's weird though, they are going to launch that from French Guiana. The launch vehicle is going to be the Ariane 5, comes out of European Space Agency, but that's the plan. We'll see that happen in 2018, hopefully. And that's on schedule, so a lot to look forward to. I'd like to see this 100-foot telescope built, too. Anything segmented, you can do that now. I mean, one piece, that's a lot of problems. The weight alone is a problem. Now, you have all these things, you can realign them and keep them in line with laser beams and this and that. It's a big, big step forward once they put the tech together. Okay, let me drop it.
Hey, Dick, is that telescope being built here in America?
Almost all of those huge telescopes are a multi-nation thing, just like the European Southern Observatory really has a whole bunch of nations, including the United States, contributing to that effort. The James Webb Telescope, for instance, yes, it's being managed by NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, I think, or the, what is that, telescope, something or other society, you know, the one in Maryland. But the detector assembly might be built in Germany, and the alignment procedure is built in California Institute of Technology, at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. It's a multi-nation, multi-vendor type thing. These really big telescopes rarely are just one guy like Palomar, if you know what I mean. So I think there's a lot of hands involved in this one. See if what polls you can stand this one. WS2N, KQLIW.
Yeah, that's one advantage of the International Space Station. You know, it showed 16 countries could come together and put a $100 billion thing flying around in space at 17,000 plus miles an hour. That's an amazing accomplishment to get all these countries to work together to do that. And now we have astronauts from all over the world going to the space station. Well, you can do that there. You can do it on the ground, too. You did it in Antarctica. You know, you've got multiple nations down there. And, it's a good way to go. It helps keep peace in the world, too, I think. Anything like that puts the world in the right direction. You're going to see a lot of interplanetary, maybe future moon missions, all with multiple countries involved. So, I think the last big all-American telescope was the Hubble. That mirror was completely